Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers.
My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm the host of this podcast, and I hope you enjoy it.
In today's episode, we're going to zoom in on six of the presentations that were held at the annual meeting of the European Academy of Neurology Congress, so the EAN 2023, which was held in Budapest, Hungary from the 1st through the 4th of July 2023. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
We're going to kick off with a presentation about the EAN guidelines on the management of ALS, so amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. This was presented by Professor Philip van Dam. He's at the University Hospital Gasthuisberg in Belgium. This new version of the guidelines replaces the previous guidelines, which dated back to 2012. Professor van Dam explained that his 26 research questions were identified using the PICO framework, and of those, 8 were recommendations adapted from the British NICE guidelines, the NICE guidelines, NG42, the motor neuron disease. The other 16 were de novo recommendations. A cornerstone of ALS management is multidisciplinary care. The evidence is based mostly on observational studies. A team ideally consists of an ALS neurologist, a respiratory specialist, a nursing professional, a mental health professional, a social worker, a speech-language pathologist, a dietitian, and a physical therapist. The main recommendations concerning disease-modifying therapies are the following. Number 1, riluzole should be offered lifelong to all ALS patients at diagnosis. Professor van Dam said, quote, a single daily dose of 50 milligrams can already be effective, end quote. Number 2, cell-based therapies are not recommended outside the context of clinical trials until positive phase 3 trial data is available. Number 3, edaravone and AMX0035 both receive temporary recommendations. The guideline committee wants to await the phase 3 trial results before issuing a final recommendation. And number 4, tofersen should be offered as first-line treatment in patients with progressive ALS caused by mutations in superoxide dismutase, or SOD1. The possibility of serious adverse events should be discussed with the patient. There are ongoing randomized controlled trials for nutritional interventions, but there are no RCTs for gastrostomy. Nevertheless, that should be discussed at an early stage and thereafter, explaining the benefits of early placement and the possible risks of late gastrostomy. In conclusion, Professor van Dam expressed hope that an update will be necessary soon, as 3 additional drugs are likely to be evaluated by the EMA in the upcoming year. So in conclusion, the new guidelines on the management of ALS were presented at the AAN 2023 meeting, and they're projected to be published before the end of this year. The guidelines are a joint effort of the EAN in collaboration with the ERN EuroNMD, so that's one of the European reference networks. 3 new drugs are soon to be evaluated by the EMA, and they may necessitate an update of these guidelines in the near future. This next study is about how sleep changes contribute to the pathogenesis of neurodegenerative diseases. So this was a retrospective cohort study, and its aim was to investigate whether polysomnography-based sleep features were associated with the long-term risk of neurodegenerative diseases, or NDDs. The first author and study presenter was Dr. Abu Bakr Ibrahim from the Medical University of Innsbruck in Austria. And he explained that the study cohort consisted of patients who were referred to the Sleep Disorders Unit of the Medical University of Innsbruck between 2004 and 2007. The participants had to be at least 18 years of age, they had to undergo polysomnography and be free of neurodegeneration at baseline, as well as the first 5 years of follow-up. There were 1,454 assessed patients, and 999 of those met the criteria. As far as patient characteristics were concerned, only 31.7% were women, and the median age was 54.9 years. Dr. Ibrahim and his colleagues wanted to know how many patients of this core group would be diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease before the year 2022. So after a median of 12.8 years of follow-up, 75 patients, or 7.5%, had developed a neurodegenerative disease, whereas 924, or 92.5%, had not. Dr. Ibrahim said that a 1% decrease in sleep efficiency, N3 sleep, or better known as deep sleep, or REM sleep, was associated with a 1.9, a 6.5, and a 5.2 increased risk of incident neurodegeneration, respectively. After adjusting for demographics, sleep, and clinical covariates, a 1% decrease in waking within the SPT corresponded with a 2.2% reduced risk of incident NDD. Participants in the highest wake-up of SPT quartile, or the lowest REM sleep, or N3 sleep, had the shortest overall mean disease-free survival of 14.9 years. So Dr. Ibrahim said, quote, "Random forest analysis showed that the wake followed by deep sleep and REM sleep was the strongest predictor of neurodegeneration," end quote. He concluded that altered sleep architecture can be used as a marker for neurodegenerative diseases, but perhaps also as a future target for neuroprotective strategies. He said, quote, "With this, I hope to have convinced you to have a good night's sleep and to convince your patients to do the same," end quote. Sound advice. Next, we're going to cover a Danish multicenter study, which is looking at cannabis-based medicine and whether or not it could be more effective than placebo in the treatment of central neuropathic pain, or CP, during 7 weeks of treatment. Expectations, of course, going into the study for CBM were pretty high, as was the placebo effect in this study. Now, this was a presentation held by Dr. Julia Schwartz Hansen from Aarhus University Hospital in Denmark. Now, we know that central neuropathic pain, or CP, it's a complex problem. It's experienced differently from patient to patient, and it can be common in patients with, for example, MS or a spinal cord injury. It severely affects quality of life, and it's often difficult to treat. CBM, or cannabis-based medicine, has been suggested as a treatment for a wide range of diseases and symptoms, including CP. The Danish Sclerosis Association has requested a CBM with patients having high expectations of effects and a favorable safety profile compared with many non-medical grade products chronic patients already receive. Over 125 different cannabinoids are known to exist, and of specific medical interest are the delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, which is a psychotropic, and cannabidiol, CBD, which is not. Animal studies have shown promising results of CBM, and it has been difficult to confirm a clear effect of CBM on pain in humans. A meta-analysis evaluating isolated CBD for pain is lacking. So this was a Danish multicenter study, as I mentioned before, and it aimed to evaluate the effect of CBM on patient-reported CP and or spasticity in a population of patients with MS or spinal cord injury. The study had a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled parallel design. CBD and THC were investigated alone or in combination against a placebo. During 7 weeks of treatment and 4 weeks of follow-up, pain intensity was registered daily using a numeric rating scale. Study medication consisted of oral capsules of THC natural or CBD synthetic, or a combination of THC with CBD. A maximum daily dose of 22.5 milligrams, 45 milligrams, and 22.5 plus 45 milligrams was allowed. The effects on CP were reported. Assessed for eligibility were 489 patients with CP due to MS or SCI, 114 of whom had a CP score of greater than 3. The mean age was 52 years old, and 88 or 77% of them were women. The main difference in pain intensity from baseline to last week of treatment was 1.8 for placebo on that scale, 1.4 for THC, and 1.4 for CBD. And for the combination of THC plus CBD, it's 1.6. So there was no significant difference in the pain reduction between those groups. The effect sizes of THC, CBD, and THC plus CBD were 0.42, 0.45, and 0.16, respectively. The effect size of the isolated cannabinoids was 0.83 for THC and 0.71 for CBD, and pain intensity lowered in all four groups and regressed to baseline values during the 4 weeks of follow-up. So it's a bit disappointing, but c'est la vie. Moving on to epilepsy, there's been some updates there. So this was a specialized neurology clinic in Seville, Spain, who shared their successful efforts to optimize the efficacy of cenobamate in highly refractory focal epilepsy. By rapid and drastic reduction of this co-medication, higher mean cenobamate doses and very high seizure reduction rates could be achieved. So simplification of therapy can improve tolerability and adherence in general, and drug-resistant epilepsy, DRE, in particular. In patients with DRE who start to use cenobamate, it's not always possible to withdraw other medication, but the reduction of their pharmacological burden translates into a positive impact on their quality of life. In the current study, which was presented by Dr. Juan Sanchez Caro from the Advanced Neurology Center in Spain, was triggered by another Spanish study of cenobamate in patients with DRE, showing a high response regardless of prior and concomitant medication. One of the partaking centers, as the Advanced Neurology Center in Seville, decided to describe the results of the participants from their hospital, focusing on consequences of rapidly reducing co-medications when prescribing cenobamate. 34 participants were included, and after 3 months, the mean cenobamate dosage was already 208 milligrams, and after 12 months, it was 326 milligrams. At baseline, again 34 patients, the mean number of seizures was 57.8, and this was reduced to 5.6 after 1 month in 21 patients, and after 12 months, a greater than 50% seizure reduction was achieved by 18 participants. Seizure freedom, on the other hand, was achieved by 7 participants, or exactly one-third of the number of participants. The number needed to treat a greater than 75% reduction in seizure rate was 1.4, which looks really very promising. The mean defined daily dose of concomitant anti-seizure drugs decreased significantly from 3.6 DDD at baseline to 1.4 DDD after 12 months, and that was significant. Most of the co-medications were given above the DDD at baseline, but all dosages were reduced, on average by greater than 60%. Often, drugs were terminated altogether, and for example, after 12 months, 40% had terminated carbamazepine use and 80% had reduced lacosamide use. The mean number of concomitant anti-seizure drugs lowered from 2.9 at baseline to 1.6 at 12 months. At baseline, adverse events were frequent, including ataxia in 35% of the patients, dizziness in 53%, and somnolence at 65%. But these decreased significantly at 12 months, to ataxia being only from 35% down to 4%, from 53% dizziness down to 10%, and drowsiness going from 65% to 30%. No skin rash was detected, and the authors concluded that when using cenobamate, rapid co-medication reduction may be the approach needed to optimize its efficacy, tolerability, and the quality of life of patients with epilepsy. In patients with idiopathic intracranial hypertension, or IIH, GLP-1 agonists were found to be a safe and effective treatment option for achieving significant weight loss. The therapy was also associated with favorable headache outcomes, although possibly through an indirect effect of weight loss as well as a direct effect on intracranial pressure. IIH is considered an obesity-related disorder, mostly occurring in young obese women. Glucagon-like peptide or GLP-1 agonists, such as liraglutide or semaglutide, represent an attractive treatment option for sustained weight loss, and they're indicated for patients with a BMI of greater than or equal to 30, or a BMI of 27 to 30 with comorbidities. Dr. Nick Kreinch from the Medical University of Vienna in Austria explained that the hypothesis that GLP-1 agonists could indirectly, or perhaps also directly, positively affect headache in IIH. In this open-label single-center case-control pilot study, participants had IIH and a BMI of greater than or equal to 30. They were offered a GLP-1 agonist besides usual care weight management in the form of dietary counseling and non-supervised physical exercise. IIH medicine was continued independently. Controls were age, sex, and BMI matched IIH patients who were electing only the usual care weight management approach only. The primary endpoint was percentage of weight loss at 6 months, and non-weight-related outcomes included headache, ophthalmological parameters, and safety. A total of 39 IIH patients were included in the analysis, and their mean age was 33.6 years, 92.3% were female, and the median BMI was 36.3. Of those 39 participants, 13 received GLP-1 agonists, 11 of which received semaglutide, and 2 of which received liraglutide, while 26 received the usual care for weight management by choice. After 6 months, mean weight loss was higher in the GLP agonist group at a minus of 12% versus a minus of 2.8% of the body weight, baseline body weight. A higher proportion of patients in the GLP-1 agonist group lost greater than or equal to 10% of their weight and at 6 months, and the median reduction in the number of monthly headache days was higher in the GLP agonist group. The study period was too short to prove an effect on visual outcomes. GLP agonist treatment was overall safe and well tolerated, and there were 9 patients in the GLP-1 agonist group who reported at least one adverse event, however. Most common was nausea at nearly 70%, decreased appetite at 15.4%, and increased lipase, which was 23.1%. There were no serious adverse events and no elevation of liver or pancreatic enzymes observed. No adverse event led to premature discontinuation of treatment. Early use of intensive blood pressure reduction may reduce hematoma growth and improve outcome in patients with fast bleeding spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage, or ICH. And this was a statement that was concluded from an exploratory analysis of data from the ATTACH-2 randomized controlled trial. ICH patients with the highest risk of hematoma growth potentially benefit the most from anti-expansion treatment. Professor Qi Li from Chongqing Medical University in China, in the first phase 3 ATTACH-2 trial, intensive blood pressure lowering in ICH patients was meant to achieve a target systolic value between 110 and 139 millimeters of mercury, and it did not lower the rate of death or disability compared with the standard blood pressure reduction to a target of 140 to 179 millimeters of mercury. For this intervention to be effective, Professor Li suggested, quote, "We have to do it early and fast," end quote. The aim of the presented analysis was to determine whether intensive blood pressure reduction benefits patients with fast bleeding ICH and to evaluate the associations between fast bleeding ICH, hematoma growth, and outcome. The study population consisted of 940 participants in the ATTACH-2 trial. Fast bleeding ICH was defined as an ICH volume to CT time of greater than or equal to 5 milliliters per hour. Of the 940 selected patients, 567, or 58.9%, met this definition. Intensive blood pressure reduction was found to attenuate hematoma growth in fast-bleeding ICH. Multivariable logistic regression analysis showed that the risk of hematoma expansion of greater than 33% was lowered in fast-bleeding patients. In slow-bleeding patients, however, this was not the case, with an objective response rate of 0.97. In a subgroup of 266 patients, or 46.9%, fast-bleeding patients who presented early and could be treated within 2 hours with intensive blood pressure lowering, it was associated with improved functional independence of nearly twofold. Professor Li concluded, quote, "These results support the analysis that early use of intensive blood pressure reduction therapy reduces hematoma growth and improves outcome in fast-bleeding patients. Any therapy aimed at limiting hematoma growth, such as hemostatic therapy or reversal of anticoagulation, might also need to be focused on fast-bleeding patients. ICH patients presenting early with a high ratio of initial ICA volume over time to presentation may specifically benefit from intensive blood pressure reduction," end quote. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. I hope you learned something, and stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.